Chapter 13. The Way of Transgressors. Davy and Dora were ready for Sunday school. They were going alone, which did not often happen, for Mrs. Lynde always attended Sunday school. But Mrs. Lynde had twisted her ankle and was lame, so she was staying home this morning. The twins were also to represent the family at church, for Anne had gone away the evening before to spend Sunday with friends in Carmody, and Marilla had one of her headaches. Davy came downstairs slowly. Dora was waiting in the hall for him, having been made ready by Mrs. Lynde. Davy had attended to his own preparations. He had sent in his pocket for the Sunday school collection, and a 5-cent piece for the church collection. He carried his Bible in one hand, and his Sunday school quarterly in the other. He knew his lesson, and his golden text, and his catechism question perfectly. Had he not studied them, perforce, in Mrs. Lynde's kitchen, all last Sunday afternoon? Davy, therefore, should have been in a placid frame of mind. As a matter of fact, despite text and catechism, he was inwardly as a ravening wolf. Mrs. Lynde limped out of her kitchen as he joined Dora. "Are you clean?" she demanded severely. "Yes, all of me that shows," Davy answered with a defiant scowl. Mrs. Rachel sighed. She had her suspicions about Davy's neck and ears, but she knew that if she attempted to make a personal examination, Davy would likely take to his heels and she could not pursue him today. "Well, be sure you behave yourselves," she warned them. "Don't walk in the dust. Don't stop in the porch to talk to other children. Don't squirm or wriggle in your places. Don't forget the golden text. Don't lose your collection or forget to put it in. Don't whisper at prayer time, and don't forget to pay attention to the sermon." Davy deigned no response. He marched away down the lane, followed by the meek Dora, but his soul seethed within him. Davy had suffered, or thought he had suffered, many things at the hands and tongue of Mrs. Rachel Lynde since she had come to Green Gables. For Mrs. Lynde could not live with anybody, whether they were 9 or 90, without trying to bring them up properly. And it was only the preceding afternoon that she had interfered to influence Marilla against allowing Davy to go fishing with the Timothy Cottons. Davy was still boiling over this. As soon as he was out of the lane, Davy stopped and twisted his countenance into such an unearthly and terrific contortion that Dora, although she knew his gifts in that respect, was honestly alarmed lest he should never in the world be able to get it straightened out again.
"Darn her!" exploded Davy.
"Oh, Davy, don't swear," gasped Dora in dismay.
"Darn isn't swearing, not real swearing, and I don't care if it is," retorted Davy recklessly.
"Well, if you must say dreadful words, don't say them on Sunday," pleaded Dora.
Davy was as yet far from repentance, but in his secret soul he felt that perhaps he had gone a little too far.
"I'm going to invent a swear word of my own," he declared.
"God will punish you if you do," said Dora solemnly.
"Then I think God is a mean old scamp," retorted Davy. "Doesn't he know a fellow must have some way of expressing his feelings?"
"Davy," said Dora.
She expected that Davy would be struck down dead on the spot, but nothing happened.
"Anyway, I ain't gonna stand any more for Mrs. Lynde's bossing," spluttered Davy. "Anne and Marilla may have the right to boss me, but she hasn't. I'm gonna do every single thing she told me not to do. You watch me."
In grim, deliberate silence, while Dora watched him with the fascination of horror, Davy stepped off the green grass of the roadside, ankle deep into the fine dust which 4 weeks of rainless weather had made on the road, marched along in it, shuffling his feet viciously until he was enveloped in a hazy cloud.
"That's the beginning," he announced triumphantly. "And I'm gonna stop in the porch and talk as long as there's anybody there to talk to. I'm gonna squirm and wriggle and whisper, and I'm gonna say I don't know the golden text, and I'm gonna throw away both of my collections right now."
And Davy hurled cent and nickel over Mr. Barry's fence with fierce delight.
"Satan made you do that," said Dora reproachfully.
"He didn't," cried Davy indignantly. "I just thought it out for myself, and I've thought of something else. I'm not gonna go to Sunday school or church at all. I'm going up to play with the Cottons. They told me yesterday they weren't going to Sunday school today because their mother was away and there was nobody to make them. Come along, Dora. We'll have a great time.
I don't want to go, protested Dora.
You've got to, said Davy. If you don't come, I'll tell Marilla that Frank Bell kissed you in school last Monday.
I couldn't help it. I didn't know he was going to, cried Dora, blushing scarlet.
Well, you didn't slap him or seem a bit cross, retorted Davy. I'll tell her that, too, if you don't come. We'll take the shortcut up this field.
I'm afraid of those cows, protested poor Dora, seeing a prospect of escape.
The very idea of your being scared of those cows, scoffed Davy. Why, they're both younger than you.
They're bigger, said Dora.
They won't hurt you. Come along now. This is great. When I grow up, I ain't gonna bother going to church at all. I believe I can get to heaven by myself.
You'll go to the other place if you break the Sabbath day, said unhappy Dora, following him sorely against her will. But Davy was not scared. Yet. Hell was very far off, and the delights of a fishing expedition with the Cottons was very near. He wished Dora had more spunk. She kept looking back as if she were going to cry every minute, and that spoiled a fellow's fun. Hang girls, anyway. Davy did not say darn this time, even in thought. He was not sorry, yet, but he had said it once, but it might be as well not to tempt the unknown powers too far on one day. The small Cottons were playing in their backyard and hailed Davy's appearance with whoops of delight. Pete, Tommy, Adolphus, and Mirabelle Cotton were all alone. Their mother and older sisters were away. Dora was thankful Mirabelle was there, at least. She had been afraid she would be alone in a crowd of boys. Mirabelle was almost as bad as a boy. She was so noisy and sunburned and reckless, but at least she wore dresses.
We've come to go fishing, announced Davy.
Whoop, yelled the Cottons. They rushed away to dig worms at once, Mirabelle leading the van with a tin can. Dora could have sat down and cried. Oh, if only that hateful Frank Bell had never kissed her. Then she could have defied Davy and gone to her beloved Sunday school. They dared not, of course, go fishing on the pond, where they would be seen by people going to church. They had to resort to the brook in the woods behind the cotton house. But it was full of trout, and they had a glorious time that morning. At least, the cotton certainly had, and Davy seemed to have it. Not being entirely bereft of prudence, he had discarded boots and stockings and borrowed Tommy Cotton's overalls. Thus accoutred, bog and marsh and undergrowth had no terrors for him. Dora was frankly and manifestly miserable. She followed the others in their peregrinations from pool to pool, clasping her Bible and quarterly tightly and thinking with bitterness of soul of her beloved class where she should be sitting that very moment, before a teacher she adored. Instead, here she was roaming the woods with those half-wild Cottons, trying to keep her boots clean and her pretty white dress free from rents and stains. Mirabelle had offered the loan of an apron, but Dora had scornfully refused. The trout bit as they always do on Sundays. In an hour the transgressors had all the fish they wanted, so they returned to the house, much to Dora's relief. She sat primly on a hencoop in the yard while the others played an uproarious game of tag, and then they all climbed the top of the pighouse roof and cut their initials on the saddleboard. The flat-roofed henhouse and a pile of straw beneath gave Davy another inspiration. They spent a splendid half-hour climbing on the roof and diving off into the straw with whoops and yells. But even unlawful pleasures must come to an end. When the rumble of wheels over the pond bridge told that people were going home from church, Davy knew they must go. He discarded Tommy's overalls, resumed his own rightful attire, and turned away from his string of trout with a sigh. No use to think of taking them home.
Well, hadn't we a splendid time? He demanded defiantly as they went down the hill field.
I hadn't, said Dora flatly. And I don't believe you had, really, either, she added, with a flash of insight that was not to be expected of her.
I had so, cried Davy, but in the voice of one who doth protest too much. No wonder you hadn't, just sitting there like a mule.
I ain't going to associate with the Cottons, said Dora loftily.
The Cottons are all right, retorted Davy, and they have far better times than we have. They do just as they please, and say just what they like before everybody. I'm gonna do that too after this.
There are lots of things you wouldn't dare say before everybody, averred Dora.
No, there isn't.
There is too. Would you, demanded Dora gravely, would you say Tomcat before the minister?
This was a staggerer. Davy was not prepared for such a concrete example of the freedom of speech, but one did not have to be consistent with Dora.
Of course not, he admitted sulkily. Tomcat isn't a holy word. I wouldn't mention such an animal before a minister at all.
But if you had to, persisted Dora.
I'd call it a Thomas Pussy, said Davy.
I think Gentleman Cat would be more polite, reflected Dora.
You thinking, retorted Davy with withering scorn.
Davy was not feeling comfortable, though he would have died before he admitted it to Dora. Now that the exhilaration of truant delights had died away, his conscience was beginning to give him salutary twinges. After all, perhaps it would have been better to have gone to Sunday school and church. Mrs. Lynde might be bossy, but there was always a box of cookies in her kitchen cupboard, and she was not stingy. At this inconvenient moment, Davy remembered that when he had torn his new school pants the week before, Mrs. Lynde had mended them beautifully and never said a word to Marilla about them. But Davy's cup of iniquity was not yet full. He was to discover that one sin demands another to cover it. They had dinner with Mrs. Lynde that day, and the first thing she asked Davy was,
"Were all your class in Sunday school today?"
"Yes'm,"
said Davy with a gulp. "All were there, except one."
"Did you say your golden text in catechism?"
"Yes'm."
"Did you put your collection in?"
"Yes'm."
"Was Mrs. Malcolm McPherson in church?"
"I don't know."
This, at least, was the truth, thought wretched Davy.
"Was the ladies' aid announced for next week?"
"Yes'm,"
quakingly.
"Was prayer meeting?"
I don't know."
"You should know. You should listen more attentively to the announcements. What was Mr. Harvey's text?"
Davy took a frantic gulp of water and swallowed it and the last protest of conscience together. He glibly recited an old golden text learned several weeks ago. Fortunately, Mrs. Lynde now stopped questioning him, but Davy did not enjoy his dinner. He could only eat one helping of pudding.
"What is the matter with you?" demanded justly astonished Mrs. Lynde. "Are you sick?"
"No,"
muttered Davy.
"Well, you look pale. You better keep out of the sun this afternoon," admonished Mrs. Lynde.
"Do you know how many lies you told Mrs. Lynde?"
asked Dora reproachfully, as soon as they were alone after dinner. Davy, goaded to desperation, turned fiercely.
"I don't know and I don't care," he said. "You just shut up, Dora Keith."
Then poor Davy betook himself to a secluded retreat behind the woodpile to think over the way of transgressors. Green Gables was wrapped in darkness and silence when Anne reached home. She lost no time going to bed, for she was very tired and sleepy. There had been several Avonlea jollifications the preceding week, involving rather late hours. Anne's head was hardly on her pillow before she was half asleep, but just then her door was softly opened and a pleading voice said,
"Anne?"
Anne sat up drowsily.
"Davy, is that you? What is the matter?"
A white-clad figure flung itself across the floor and onto the bed.
"Anne," sobbed Davy, getting his arms about her neck, "I'm awful glad you're home. I couldn't go to sleep till I told somebody."
"Told somebody what?"
"How miserable I am."
"Why are you miserable, dear?"
"'Cause I was bad today, Anne. Oh, I was awful bad. Badder than I've ever been yet."
"What did you do?"
"Oh, I'm afraid to tell you. You'll never like me again, Anne. I couldn't say my prayers tonight. I couldn't tell God what I'd done. I was ashamed to have him know."
"But he knew anyway, Davy."
"That's what Dora said. But I thought perhaps he mightn't have noticed just at the time. Anyway, I'd rather tell you first.
What is it you did?
Out it all came in a rush.
I ran away from Sunday school and went fishing with the Cottons, and when I told ever so many whoppers to Mrs. Lynde, oh, most half a dozen, and I said a swear word, Anne, a pretty near swear word anyhow, and I called God names.
There was a silence. Davy didn't know what to make of it. Was Anne so shocked that she never would speak to him again?
Anne, what are you going to do to me?
He whispered.
Nothing, dear. You've been punished already, I think.
No, I haven't. Nothing's been done to me.
You've been very unhappy ever since you did wrong, haven't you?
You bet,
said Davy emphatically. That was your conscience punishing you, Davy.
What's my conscience? I want to know.
It's something in you, Davy, that always tells you when you are doing wrong and makes you unhappy if you persist in doing it. Haven't you noticed that?
Yes, but I didn't know what it was. I wish I didn't have it. I'd have lots more fun. Where is my conscience, Anne? I want to know. Is it in my stomach?
No, it's in your soul,
answered Anne, thankful for the darkness, since gravity must be preserved in serious matters.
I suppose I can't get clear of it then, said Davy with a sigh. Are you going to tell Marilla and Mrs. Lynde on me, Anne?
No, dear, I'm not going to tell anyone. You are sorry you were naughty, aren't you?
You bet.
And you'll never be bad like that again.
No, but,
added Davy cautiously,
I might be bad some other way.
You won't say naughty words or run away on Sundays or tell falsehoods to cover up your sins?
No, it doesn't pay,
said Davy. Well, Davy, just tell God you are sorry and ask him to forgive you.
Have you forgive me, Anne?
Yes, dear.
Then, said Davy joyously, I don't care much whether God does or not.
Davy?
Oh, I'll ask him,
said Davy quickly, scrambling off the bed, convinced by Anne's tone that he must have said something dreadful.
I don't mind asking him, Anne. Please, God, I'm awful sorry I behaved bad today, and I'll try to be good on Sundays, always, and please forgive me. There now, Anne.
Well, now run off to bed like a good boy.
All right. Say I don't feel miserable anymore. I feel fine. Good night.
Good night.
Anne slipped down on her pillows with a sigh of relief. Oh, how sleepy she was. In another second...
Anne?
Davy was back again by her bed. Anne dragged her eyes open.
What is it now, dear?
She asked, trying to keep a note of impatience out of her voice.
Anne, have you ever noticed how Mr. Harrison spits? You suppose if I practice hard, I can learn to spit just like him?
Anne sat up.
Davy Keith, she said, go straight to your bed and don't let me catch you out of it again tonight. Go now.
Davy went and stood not upon the order of his going. Chapter 14. The Summons. Anne was sitting with Ruby Gillis in the Gillis' garden after the day had crept lingeringly through it and was gone. It had been a warm, smoky summer afternoon. The world was in a splendor of outflowering. The idle valleys were full of hazes. The woodways were pranked with shadows and the fields with the purple of the asters. Anne had given up a moonlight drive to the White Sands beach that she might spend the evening with Ruby. She had so spent many evenings that summer, although she often wondered what good it did anyone, and sometimes went home deciding that she could not go again. Ruby grew paler as the summer waned. The White Sands school was given up. Her father thought it better that she shouldn't teach till New Year's. And the fancy work she loved oftener and oftener fell from hands grown too weary for it. But she was always gay, always hopeful, always chattering and whispering of her beau and their rivalries and despairs. It was this that made Anne's visits hard for her. What had once been silly or amusing was gruesome now. It was death peering through a willful mask of life. Yet Ruby seemed to cling to her and never let her go until she had promised to come again soon. Mrs. Lynde grumbled about Anne's frequent visits and declared she would catch consumption. Even Marilla was dubious. "Every time you go to see Ruby, you come home looking tired out," she said.
"It's so very sad and dreadful," said Anne in a low tone. "Ruby doesn't seem to realize her condition in the least, and yet I somehow feel she needs help, craves it, and I want to give it to her and can't. All the time I'm with her, I feel as if I were watching her struggle with an invisible foe, trying to push it back with such feeble resistance as she has. That is why I come home tired." But tonight, Anne did not feel this so keenly. Ruby was strangely quiet. She said not a word about parties and drives and dresses and fellows. She lay in the hammock with her untouched work beside her and a white shawl wrapped about her thin shoulders. Her long yellow braids of hair, how Anne had envied those beautiful braids in old school days, lay on either side of her. She had taken the pins out. They made her head ache, she said. The hectic flush was gone for the time, leaving her pale and childlike. The moon rose in the silvery sky, empearling the clouds around her. Below, the pond shimmered in its hazy radiance. Just beyond the Gillis homestead was the church, with the old graveyard beside it. The moonlight shone on the white stones, bringing them out in clear-cut relief against the dark trees behind. "How strange the graveyard looks by moonlight," said Ruby suddenly. "How ghostly," she shuddered. "Anne, it won't be long now before I'll be lying over there. You and Diana and all the rest will be going about full of life, and I'll be there, in the old graveyard, dead."
The surprise of it bewildered Anne. For a few moments she could not speak.
"You know it's so, don't you?" said Ruby insistently.
"Yes, I know," answered Anne in a low tone. "Dear Ruby, I know."
"Everybody knows it," said Ruby bitterly. "I know it. I've known it all summer, though I wouldn't give in. And oh, Anne."
She reached out and caught Anne's hand pleadingly, impulsively.
"I don't want to die. I'm afraid to die."
"Why should you be afraid, Ruby?" asked Anne quietly.
Because, oh, I'm not afraid but that I'll go to heaven, Anne. I'm a church member, but it'll be all so different, I think, and I get so frightened and homesick. Heaven must be very beautiful, of course, the Bible says so, but Anne, it won't be what I've been used to."
Through Anne's mind drifted an intrusive recollection of a funny story she had heard Philippa Gordon tell, the story of some old man who had said very much the same thing about the world to come. It had sounded funny then. She remembered how she and Priscilla had laughed over it. But it did not seem in the least humorous now, coming from Ruby's pale, trembling lips. It was sad, tragic, and true. Heaven could not be what Ruby had been used to. There had been nothing in her gay, frivolous life, her shallow ideals and aspirations, to fit her for that great change, or make the life to come seem to her anything but alien and unreal and undesirable. Anne wondered helplessly what she could say that would help her. Could she say anything? "I think, Ruby," she began hesitatingly, for it was difficult for Anne to speak to any one of the deepest thoughts of her heart, or the new ideas that have vaguely begun to shape themselves in her mind, concerning the great mysteries of life here and hereafter, superseding her old childish conceptions, and it was hardest of all to speak of them to such as Ruby Gillis. "I think, perhaps, we have very mistaken ideas about heaven, what it is and what it holds for us. I don't think it can be so very different from life here as most people seem to think. I believe we'll just go on living, a good deal as we live here, and be ourselves just the same. Only it will be easier to be good and to
follow the highest. All the hindrances and perplexities will be taken away, and we shall see clearly. Don't be afraid, Ruby.
I can't help it, said Ruby pitifully. Even if what you say about heaven is true, and you can't be sure, it may be only that imagination of yours. It won't be just the same. It can't be. I want to go on living here. I'm so young, Anne. I haven't had my life. I fought so hard to live, and it isn't any use. I have to die and leave everything I care for.
Anne sat in the pain that was almost intolerable. She could not tell comforting falsehoods, and all that Ruby said was horribly true. She was leaving everything she cared for. She had laid up her treasures on Earth only. She had lived solely for the little things of life, the things that pass, forgetting the great things that go onward into eternity, bridging the gulf between the two lives, and making of death a mere passing from one dwelling to the other, from twilight to unclouded day. God would take care of her there, Anne believed. She would learn. But now it was no wonder her soul clung in blind helplessness to the only things she knew and loved. Ruby raised herself on her arm and lifted up her bright, beautiful blue eyes to the moonlit skies.
I want to live, she said in a trembling voice. I want to live like other girls. I want to be married, Anne, and have little children. You know I always loved babies, Anne. I couldn't say this to anyone but you. I know you understand. And then poor Herb, he loves me, and I love him, Anne. The others meant nothing to me, but he does. And if I could live, I would be his wife and be so happy. Oh, Anne, it's hard.
Ruby sank back on her pillows and sobbed convulsively. Anne pressed her hand in an agony of sympathy, silent sympathy, which perhaps helped Ruby more than broken, imperfect words could have done. For presently, she grew calmer and her sobs ceased.
I'm glad I've told you this, Anne,
she whispered.
It has helped me just to say it all out. I've wanted to all summer. Every time you came, I wanted to talk it over with you. But I couldn't. It seemed as if it would make death so sure if I said I was going to die, or if anyone else said it or hinted it. I wouldn't say it or even think it. In the daytime when people were around me and everything was cheerful, it wasn't so hard to keep from thinking it. But in the night, when I couldn't sleep, it was so dreadful, Anne. I couldn't get away from it then. Death just came and stared me in the face, until I got so frightened I could have screamed.
But you won't be frightened any more, Ruby, will you? You'll be brave and believe that all is going to be well with you.
I'll try. I'll think over what you have said and try to believe it. And you'll come up as often as you can, won't you, Anne?
Yes, dear.
It won't be very long now, Anne. I feel sure of that. And I'd rather have you than anyone else. I've always liked you best of all the girls I went to school with. You were never jealous or mean like some of them were. Poor Em White was up to see me yesterday. You remember Em and I were such chums for 3 years when we went to school? And then we quarreled the time of the school concert. We've never spoken to each other since. Wasn't it silly? Anything like that seems silly now. But Em and I made up the old quarrel yesterday. She said she'd have spoken years ago, only she thought I wouldn't. And I never spoke to her because I was sure she wouldn't speak to me. Isn't it strange how people misunderstand each other, Anne?
Most of the trouble in life comes from misunderstanding, I think, said Anne. I must go now, Ruby. It's getting late. And you shouldn't be out in the damp.
You'll come up soon again?
Yes, very soon. And if there's anything I can do to help you, I'll be so glad.
I know. You have helped me already. Nothing seems quite so dreadful now. Good night, Anne.
Good night, dear.
Anne walked home very slowly in the moonlight. The evening had changed something for her. Life held a different meaning, a deeper purpose. On the surface, it would go on just the same, but the deeps had been stirred. It must not be with her as with poor Butterfly Ruby. When she came to the end of one life, it must not be to face the next with the shrinking terror of something wholly different, something for which accustomed thought and ideal and aspiration had unfitted her. The little things of life, sweet and excellent in their place, must not be the things lived for. The highest must be sought and followed. The life of heaven must be begun here on earth. That good night in the garden was for all time. Anne never saw Ruby in life again. The next night, the AVIS gave a farewell party to Jane Andrews before her departure for the West. And while light feet danced and bright eyes laughed and merry tongues chattered, there came a summons to a soul in Avonlea that might not be disregarded or evaded. The next morning, the word went from house to house that Ruby Gillis was dead. She had died in her sleep, painlessly and calmly, and on her face was a smile, as if, after all, death had come as a kindly friend to lead her over the threshold instead of the grisly phantom she had dreaded. Mrs. Rachel Lynde said emphatically after the funeral that Ruby Gillis was the handsomest corpse she ever laid eyes on. Her loveliness as she lay, white-clad, among the delicate flowers that Anne had placed about her, was remembered and talked of for years in Avonlea. Ruby had always been beautiful, but her beauty had been of the earth, earthy. It had had a certain insolent quality in it, as if it flaunted itself in the beholder's eye. Spirit had never shone through it. Intellect had never refined it. But death had touched it and consecrated it, bringing out delicate modelings and purity of outline never seen before. Doing what life and love and great sorrow and deep womanhood joys might have done for Ruby, Anne, looking down through a mist of tears at her old playfellow, thought she saw the face God had meant Ruby to have, and remembered it so always. Mrs. Gillis called Anne aside into a vacant room before the funeral procession left the house and gave her a small packet. "I want you to have this," she sobbed. "Ruby would have liked you to have it. It's the embroidered centerpiece she was working at. It isn't quite finished. The needle is sticking in it just where her poor little fingers put it the last time she laid it down, the afternoon before she died." "There's always a piece of unfinished work left," said Mrs. Lynde with tears in her eyes, "but I suppose there's always someone to finish it."
How difficult it is to realize that one we have always known can really be dead, said Anne, as she and Diana walked home. "Ruby is the first of our schoolmates to go. One by one, sooner or later, all the rest of us must follow."
"Yes, I suppose so," said Diana uncomfortably. She did not want to talk of that. She would have preferred to have discussed the details of the funeral, the splendid white velvet casket Mr. Gillis had insisted on having for Ruby. "The Gillises must always make a splurge, even at funerals," quoth Mrs. Rachel Lynde. Herb Spencer's sad face, the uncontrolled hysteric grief of one of Ruby's sisters. But Anne would not talk of these things. She seemed wrapped in a reverie in which Diana felt lonesomely that she had neither lot nor part.
"Ruby Gillis was a great girl to laugh," said Davy suddenly. "Will she laugh as much in heaven as she did in Avonlea, Anne? I want to know."
"Yes, I think she will," said Anne.
"Oh, Anne," protested Diana, with a rather shocked smile.
"Well, why not, Diana?" asked Anne seriously. "Do you think we'll never laugh in heaven?"
"Oh, I don't know," floundered Diana. "It doesn't seem just right, somehow. You know, it's rather dreadful to laugh in church."
"But heaven won't be like church all the time," said Anne.
"I hope it ain't," said Davy emphatically. "If it is, I don't want to go. Church is awful dull. Anyway, I don't mean to go for ever so long. I mean to live to be 100 years old, like Mr. Thomas Blewett of White Sands. He says he lived so long because he always smoked tobacco and it killed all the germs. Can I smoke tobacco pretty soon, Anne?
No, Davy, I hope you'll never use tobacco, said Anne absently.
What'll you feel like if the germs kill me then? Demanded Davy.
Chapter 15. A Dream Turned Upside Down.
Just one more week and we go back to Redmond, said Anne. She was happy at the thought of returning to work, classes, and Redmond friends. Pleasing visions were also being woven around Patty's place. There was a warm, pleasant sense of home in the thought of it, even though she had never lived there. But the summer had been a very happy one, too, a time of glad living with summer suns and skies, a time of keen delight in wholesome things, a time of renewing and deepening of old friendships, a time in which she had learned to live more nobly, to work more patiently, to play more heartily. All life lessons are not learned at college, she thought. Life teaches them everywhere. But alas, the final week of that pleasant vacation was spoiled for Anne by one of those impish happenings which are like a dream turned upside down.
Been writing any more stories lately? Inquired Mr. Harrison genially one evening when Anne was taking tea with him and Mrs. Harrison.
No,
answered Anne rather crisply.
Well, no offense meant. Mrs. Hiram Sloane told me the other day that a big envelope addressed to the Rollings Reliable Baking Powder Company of Montreal had been dropped into the post office box a month ago, and she suspicioned that somebody was trying for the prize they'd offered for the best story that introduced the name of their baking powder. She said it wasn't addressed in your writing, but I thought maybe it was you.
Indeed, no. I saw the prize offer, but I'd never dream of competing for it. I think it would be perfectly disgraceful to write a story to advertise a baking powder. It would be almost as bad as Judson Parker's patent medicine fence. So spake Anne loftily, little dreaming of the valley of humiliation awaiting her. That very evening, Diana popped into the porch gable, bright-eyed and rosy-cheeked, carrying a letter.
Oh, Anne, here's a letter for you. I was at the office, so I thought I'd bring it along. Do open it quick. If it is what I believe it is, I shall just be wild with delight.
Anne, puzzled, opened the letter and glanced over the typewritten contents. Miss Anne Shirley, Green Gables, Avonlea, P.E. Island. Dear Madam, we have much pleasure in informing you that your charming story, Averill's Atonement, has won the prize of $25 offered in our recent competition. We enclose the check herewith. We are arranging for the publication of the story in several prominent Canadian newspapers, and we also intend to have it printed in pamphlet form for distribution among our patrons. Thank you for the interest you have shown in our enterprise. We remain, yours very truly, the Rollings Reliable Baking Powder Company.
I don't understand, said Anne blankly.
Diana clapped her hands.
Oh, I knew it would win the prize. I was sure of it. I sent your story into the competition, Anne.
Diana Barry!
Yes, I did, said Diana gleefully, perching herself on the bed. When I saw the offer, I thought of your story in a minute, and at first I thought I'd ask you to send it in, but then I was afraid you wouldn't. You had so little faith left in it, so I just decided I'd send the copy you gave me and say nothing about it. Then, if it didn't win the prize, you'd never know, and you wouldn't feel badly over it, because the stories that failed were not to be returned. And if it did, you'd have such a delightful surprise.
Diana was not the most discerning of mortals, but just at this moment it struck her that Anne was not looking exactly overjoyed. The surprise was there, beyond doubt, but where was the delight?
Why, Anne, you don't seem a bit pleased, she exclaimed.
Anne instantly manufactured a smile and put it on.
Of course I couldn't be anything but pleased over your unselfish wish to give me pleasure, she said slowly. But, you know, I'm so amazed. I can't realize it, and I don't understand. There wasn't a word in my story about, Anne choked a little over the word, baking powder.
Oh, I put that in, said Diana, reassured. It was as easy as wink. And of course my experience in our old story club helped me. You know the scene where Averill makes the cake?
Well, I just stated that she used the Rowlings Reliable in it, and that was why it turned out so well. And then, in the last paragraph, where Percival clasps Averill in his arms and says, "Sweetheart, the beautiful coming years will bring us the fulfillment of our home of dreams," I added, "in which we will never use any baking powder except Rowlings Reliable."
Oh,
gasped poor Anne, as if someone had dashed cold water on her.
"And you've won the $25,
continued Diana jubilantly. "Why, I heard Priscilla say once that the Canadian woman only pays $5 for a story." Anne held out the hateful pink slip in shaking fingers.
"I can't take it. It's yours by right, Diana. You sent that story in and made the alterations. I would certainly never have sent it. So you must take the check."
"I'd like to see myself," said Diana scornfully. "Why, what I did wasn't any trouble."
"The honor of being a friend of the prize winner is enough for me. Well, I must go. I should have gone straight home from the post office, for we have company, but I simply had to come and hear the news. I'm so glad for your sake, Anne."
Anne suddenly bent forward, put her arms about Diana, and kissed her cheek. "I think you are the sweetest and truest friend in the world, Diana," she said, with a little tremble in her voice. "And I assure you I appreciate the motive of what you've done." Diana, pleased and embarrassed, got herself away, and poor Anne, after flinging the innocent check into her bureau drawer as if it were blood money, cast herself on her bed and wept tears of shame and outraged sensibility. Oh, she could never live this down, never. Gilbert arrived at dusk, brimming over with congratulations, for he had called at Orchard Slope and heard the news, but his congratulations died on his lips at sight of Anne's face. "Why, Anne, what is the matter? I expected to find you radiant over winning Rowling's Reliable Prize. Good for you."
"Oh, Gilbert, not you,"
implored Anne in an et tu, Brute tone.
"I thought you would understand. Can't you see how awful it is?"
"I must confess I can't. What is wrong?"
"Everything," moaned Anne. "I feel as if I were disgraced forever. What do you think a mother would feel like if she found her child tattooed over with a baking powder advertisement? I feel just the same. I loved my poor little story, and I wrote it out of the best that was in me. And it is sacrilege to have it degraded to the level of a baking powder advertisement. Don't you remember what Professor Hamilton used to tell us in the literature class at Queen's? He said we were never to write a word for a low or unworthy motive, but always to cling to the very highest ideals. What will he think when he hears I've written a story to advertise Rowling's Reliable? And oh, when it gets out at Redmond, think how I'll be teased and laughed at."
"That you won't," said Gilbert, wondering uneasily if it were that confounded junior's opinion in particular over which Anne was worried. "The Reds will think just as I thought, that you, being like 9 out of 10 of us, not overburdened with worldly wealth, had taken this way of earning an honest penny to help yourself through the year. I don't see that there's anything low or unworthy about that, or anything ridiculous either. One would rather write masterpieces of literature, no doubt, but meanwhile, board and tuition fees have to be paid." This common-sense, matter-of-fact view of the case cheered Anne a little. At least it removed her dread of being laughed at, though the deeper hurt of an outraged ideal remained. Chapter 16. Adjusted Relationships.
"It's the homiest spot I ever saw. It's homier than home," avowed Philippa Gordon, looking about her with delighted eyes.
They were all assembled at twilight in the big living room at Patty's place, Anne and Priscilla, Phil and Stella, Aunt Jemisina, Rusty, Joseph, the Sarah Cat, and Gog and Magog. The firelight shadows were dancing over the walls, the cats were purring, and the huge bowl of hothouse chrysanthemums, sent to Phil by one of the victims, shone through the golden gloom like creamy moons. It was 3 weeks since they had considered themselves settled, and already all believed the experiment would be a success. The first fortnight after their return had been a pleasantly exciting one. They had been busy setting up their household goods, organizing their little establishment, and adjusting different opinions. Anne was not over sorry to leave Avonlea when the time came to return to college, The last few days of her vacation had not been pleasant. Her prize story had been published in the island papers, and Mr. William Blair had, upon the counter of his store, a huge pile of pink, green, and yellow pamphlets, containing it, one of which he gave to every customer. He sent the complimentary bundle to Anne, who promptly dropped them all in the kitchen stove. Her humiliation was the consequence of her own ideals only, for Avonlea folks thought it quite splendid that she should have won the prize. Her many friends regarded her with honest admiration, her few foes with scornful envy. Josie Pye said she believed Anne Shirley had just copied the story. She was sure she remembered reading it in a paper years before. The Sloanes, who had found out or guessed that Charlie had been turned down, said they didn't think it was much to be proud of. Almost anyone could have done it if she tried. Aunt Atossa told Anne she was very sorry to hear she had taken to writing novels. Nobody born and bred in Avonlea would do it. That was what came of adopting orphans from goodness knew where with goodness knew what kind of parents. Even Mrs. Rachel Lynde was darkly dubious about the propriety of writing fiction, though she was almost reconciled to it by that $25 check. "It's perfectly amazing the price they pay for such lies, that's what," she said, half proudly, half severely. All things considered, it was a relief when going away time came, and it was very jolly to be back at Redmond, a wise, experienced soph with hosts of friends to greet on the merry opening day. Pris and Stella and Gilbert were there. Charlie Sloane, looking more important than ever sophomore looked before. Phil, with the Alec and Alonzo question still unsettled, and Moody Spurgeon McPherson. Moody Spurgeon had been teaching school ever since leaving Queens, but his mother had concluded it was high time he gave it up and turned his attention to learning how to be a minister. Poor Moody Spurgeon fell on hard luck at the very beginning of his college career. Half a dozen ruthless sophs who were among his fellow boarders swooped down upon him one night and shaved half of his head. In this guise, the luckless Moody Spurgeon had to go about until his hair grew again. He told Anne bitterly that there were times when he had his doubts as to whether he was really called to be a minister. Aunt Jemisina did not come until the girls had Patty's place ready for her. Miss Patty had sent the key to Anne, with a letter in which she said Gog and Magog were packed in a box under the spare room bed, but might be taken out when wanted. In a postscript, she added that she hoped the girls would be careful about putting up pictures. The living room had been newly papered 5 years before, and she and Miss Maria did not want any more holes made in the new paper than was absolutely necessary. For the rest, she trusted everything to Anne. How those girls enjoyed putting their nest in order. As Phil said, it was almost as good as getting married. You had the fun of homemaking without the bother of a husband. All brought something with them to adorn or make comfortable a little house. Pris and Phil and Stella had knick-knacks and pictures galore, which latter they proceeded to hang according to taste in reckless disregard of Miss Patty's new paper. "We'll putty the holes up when we leave, dear. She'll never know," they said to protesting Anne. Diana had given Anne a pine needle cushion, and Miss Ada had given both her and Priscilla a fearfully and wonderfully embroidered one. Marilla had sent a big box of preserves, and darkly hinted at a hamper for Thanksgiving, and Mrs. Lynde gave Anne a patchwork quilt and loaned her 5 more. "You take them," she said authoritatively. "They might as well be in use as packed away in that trunk in the garret for moths to gnaw." No moths would ever have ventured near those quilts, for they reeked of mothballs to such an extent that they had to be hung in the orchard of Patty's place for a full fortnight before they could be endured indoors. Verily, aristocratic Spofford Avenue had rarely beheld such a display. The gruff old millionaire who lived next door came over and wanted to buy the gorgeous red and yellow tulip pattern one which Mrs. Rachel had given Anne. He said his mother used to make quilts like that, and by Jove, he wanted one to remind him of her. Anne would not sell it, much to his disappointment, but she wrote all about it to Mrs. Lynde. That highly gratified lady sent word back that she had one just like it to spare, so the tobacco king got his quilt after all, and insisted on having it spread on his bed, to the disgust of his fashionable wife. Mrs. Lynde's quilts served a very useful purpose that winter. Patty's place, for all its many virtues, had its faults also. It was really a rather cold house, and when the frosty nights came, the girls were very glad to snuggle down under Mrs. Lynde's quilts, and hoped that the loan of them might be accounted unto her for righteousness. Anne had the blue room she had coveted at sight. Priscilla and Stella had the large one. Phil was blissfully content with the little one over the kitchen, and Aunt Jemisina was to have the downstairs one off the living room. Rusty, at first, slept on the doorstep. Anne, walking home from Redmond a few days after her return, became aware that the people that she met surveyed her with a covert, indulgent smile. Anne wondered uneasily what was the matter with her. Was her hat crooked? Was her belt loose? Craning her head to investigate, Anne, for the first time, saw Rusty. Trotting along behind her, close to her heels, was quite the most forlorn specimen of the cat tribe she had ever beheld. The animal was well past kittenhood, lank, thin, disreputable-looking. Pieces of both ears were lacking, one eye was temporarily out of repair, and one jowl ludicrously swollen. As for color, if a once black cat had been well and thoroughly singed, the result would have resembled the hue of this waif's thin, draggled, unsightly fur. Anne shooed, but the cat would not shoo. As long as she stood, he sat back on his haunches and gazed at her reproachfully out of his one good eye. When she resumed her walk, he followed. Anne resigned herself to his company until he reached the gate of Patty's place, which she coldly shut in his face, fondly supposing she had seen the last of him. But when, 15 minutes later, Phil opened the door, there sat the rusty brown cat on the step. More, he promptly darted in and sprang upon Anne's lap with a half-pleading, half-triumphant, "Meow!" "Anne," said Stella severely, "do you own that animal?" "No, I do not," protested disgusted Anne. "The creature followed me home from somewhere. I couldn't get rid of him. Ugh, get down. I like decent cats reasonably well, but I don't like beasties of your complexion." Pussy, however, refused to get down. He coolly curled up in Anne's lap and began to purr. "He has evidently adopted you," laughed Priscilla. "I won't be adopted," said Anne stubbornly. "The poor creature is starving," said Phil pityingly. "Why, his bones are almost coming through his skin." "Well, I'll give him a square meal, and then he must return to whence he came," said Anne resolutely. The cat was fed and put out. In the morning, he was still on the doorstep. On the doorstep, he continued to sit, bolting in whenever the door was opened. No coolness of welcome had the least effect on him. Of nobody save Anne did he take the least notice. Out of compassion, the girls fed him, but when a week had passed, they decided that something must be done. The cat's appearance had improved. His eye and cheek had resumed their normal appearance. He was not quite so thin, and he had been seen washing his face. "But for all that, we can't keep him," said Stella. "Aunt Jimsy is coming next week, and she will bring the Sarah cat with her. We can't keep two cats, and if we did, this rusty coat would fight all the time with the Sarah cat. He's a fighter by nature. He had a pitched battle last evening with the Tobacco King's cat and routed him horse, foot, and artillery." "We must get rid of him," agreed Anne, looking darkly at the subject of their discussion, who was purring on the hearthrug with an air of lamb-like meekness. "But the question is how? How can four unprotected females get rid of a cat who won't be got rid of?" "We must chloroform him," said Phil briskly. "That is the most humane way." "Who of us knows anything about chloroforming a cat?" demanded Anne gloomily. "I do, honey. It's one of my few, sadly few, useful accomplishments. I've disposed of several at home. You take the cat in the morning and give him a good breakfast. Then you take an old burlap bag. There's one in the back porch. Put the cat on it and turn over him a wooden box. Then take a 2-ounce bottle of chloroform, uncork it, and slip it under the edge of the box. Put a heavy weight on top of the box and leave it till evening. The cat will be dead, curled up peacefully as if he were asleep. No pain, no struggle."
"It sounds easy," said Anne dubiously.
"It is easy. Just leave it to me. I'll see to it," said Phil reassuringly. Accordingly, the chloroform was procured, and the next morning, Rusty was lured to his doom. He ate his breakfast, licked his chops, and climbed into Anne's lap. Anne's heart misgave her. This poor creature loved her, trusted her. How could she be a party to his destruction?
Here, take him, she said hastily to Phil. I feel like a murderess.
He won't suffer, you know, comforted Phil, but Anne had fled.
The fatal deed was done in the back porch. Nobody went near it that day, but at dusk, Phil declared that Rusty must be buried.
Pris and Stella must dig his grave in the orchard, decreed Phil, and Anne must come with me to lift the box off. That's the part I always hate.
The two conspirators tiptoed reluctantly to the back porch. Phil gingerly lifted the stone she had put on the box. Suddenly, faint but distinct, sounded an unmistakable mew under the box.
He isn't dead, gasped Anne, sitting blankly down on the kitchen doorstep.
He must be, said Phil incredulously.
Another tiny mew proved that he wasn't. The two girls stared at each other.
What will we do? Questioned Anne.
Why in the world don't you come? Demanded Stella, appearing in the doorway. We've got the grave ready. What silent still and silent all? She quoted teasingly.
Oh no, the voices of the dead sound like the distant torrent's fall.
Promptly counterquoted Anne, pointing solemnly to the box. A burst of laughter broke the tension.
We must leave him here till morning, said Phil, replacing the stone. He hasn't mewed for 5 minutes. Perhaps the mews we heard were his dying groan, or perhaps we merely imagined them under the strain of our guilty consciences.
But when the box was lifted in the morning, Rusty bounded at one gay leap to Anne's shoulder, where he began to lick her face affectionately. Never was there a cat more decidedly alive.
There's a knothole in the box, groaned Phil. I never saw it. That's why he didn't die. Now we've got to do it all over again.
No, we haven't, declared Anne suddenly. Rusty isn't going to be killed again. He's my cat, and you've just got to make the best of it.
Oh, well, if you settle with Aunt Jimsy and the Sarah cat, said Stella, with the air of one washing her hands of the whole affair.
From that time, Rusty was one of the family. He slept o' nights on the scrubbing cushion in the back porch and lived on the fat of the land. By the time Aunt Jemisina came up, he was plump and glossy and tolerably respectable. But like Kipling's cat, he walked by himself. His paw was against every cat, and every cat's paw against him. One by one, he vanquished the aristocratic felines of Spofford Avenue. As for human beings, he loved Anne and Anne alone. Nobody else even dared stroke him. An angry spit and something that sounded much like very improper language greeted anyone who did.
The airs that cat puts on are perfectly intolerable, declared Stella.
Him was a nice old pussins, him was, vowed Anne, cuddling her pet defiantly.
Well, I don't know how he and the Sarah cat will ever make out to live together, said Stella, pessimistically. Cat fights in the orchard o' nights are bad enough, but cat fights here in the living room are unthinkable.
In due time, Aunt Jemisina arrived. Anne and Priscilla and Phil had awaited her advent rather dubiously, but when Aunt Jemisina was enthroned in the rocking chair before the open fire, they figuratively bowed down and worshipped her. Aunt Jemisina was a tiny old woman with a little softly triangular face and large, soft blue eyes that were alight with unquenchable youth and as full of hopes as a girl's. She had pink cheeks and snow-white hair, which she wore in quaint little puffs over her ears.
It's a very old-fashioned way, she said,
knitting industriously at something as dainty and pink as a sunset cloud.
But I am old-fashioned. My clothes are, and it stands to reason my opinions are, too. I don't say they're any the better of that, mind you. In fact, I dare say they're a good deal the worse. But they've worn nice and easy. New shoes are smarter than old ones, but the old ones are more comfortable. I'm old enough to indulge myself in the matter of shoes and opinions. I mean to take it real easy here. I know you expect me to look after you and keep you proper, but I'm not going to do it. You're old enough to know how to behave if you're ever going to be. So as far as I'm concerned, concluded Aunt Jemisina with a twinkle in her young eyes, you can all go to destruction in your own way.
Oh, will somebody separate those cats? Pleaded Stella, shudderingly.
Aunt Jemisina had brought with her not only the Sarah cat, but Joseph. Joseph, she explained, had belonged to a dear friend of hers who had gone to live in Vancouver.
She couldn't take Joseph with her, so she begged me to take him. I really couldn't refuse. He's a beautiful cat. That is, his disposition is beautiful. She called him Joseph because his coat is of many colors. It certainly was. Joseph, as the disgusted Stella said, looked like a walking rag bag. It was impossible to say what his ground color was. His legs were white with black spots on them. His back was gray with a huge patch of yellow on one side and a black patch on the other. His tail was yellow with a gray tip. One ear was black and one yellow. The black patch over one eye gave him a fearfully rakish look. In reality, he was meek and inoffensive of a social disposition. In one respect, if in no other, Joseph was like a lily of the field. He toiled not, neither did he spin or catch mice. Yet Solomon, in all his glory, slept not on softer cushions, or feasted more fully on fat things. Joseph and Sarah Cat arrived by express in separate boxes. After they had been released and fed, Joseph selected the cushion and corner which appealed to him, and the Sarah Cat gravely sat her down before the fire and proceeded to wash her face. She was a large, sleek, gray and white cat with an enormous dignity, which was not at all impaired by any consciousness of her plebeian origin. She had been given to Aunt Jemisina by her washerwoman. Her name was Sarah, so my husband always called Puss the Sarah Cat, explained Aunt Jemisina. She's 8 years old and a remarkable mouser. Don't worry, Stella, the Sarah Cat never fights, and Joseph rarely. Well, they'll have to fight here in self-defense, said Stella. At this juncture, Rusty arrived on the scene. He bounded joyously halfway across the room before he saw the intruders. Then he stopped short. His tail expanded until it was as big as three tails. The fur on his back rose up in a defiant arch. Rusty lowered his head, uttered a fearful shriek of hatred and defiance, and launched himself at the Sarah Cat. That stately animal had stopped washing her face and was looking at him curiously. She met his onslaught with one contemptuous sweep of her capable paw. Rusty went rolling helplessly over on the rug. He picked himself up dazedly. What sort of a cat was this who had boxed his ears? He looked dubiously at the Sarah Cat. Would he, or would he not? The Sarah Cat deliberately turned her back on him and resumed her toilet operations. Rusty decided that he would not. He never did. From that time on, the Sarah Cat ruled the roost. Rusty never again interfered with her. But Joseph rashly sat up and yawned. Rusty, burning to avenge his disgrace, swooped down upon him. Joseph, pacific by nature, could fight upon occasion and fight well. The result was a series of drawn battles. Every day, Rusty and Joseph fought at sight. Anne took Rusty's part and detested Joseph. Stella was in despair, but Aunt Jemisina only laughed. "Let them fight it out," she said tolerantly. "They'll make friends after a bit. Joseph needs some exercise. He was getting too fat. And Rusty has to learn he isn't the only cat in the world." Eventually, Joseph and Rusty accepted the situation, and from sworn enemies became sworn friends. They slept on the same cushion with their paws about each other and gravely washed each other's faces.
"We've all got used to each other," said Phil, "and I've learned how to wash dishes and sweep a floor."
"But you needn't try to make us believe you can chloroform a cat," laughed Anne.
"It was all the fault of the knothole," protested Phil.
"It was a good thing the knothole was there," said Aunt Jemisina, rather severely. "Kittens have to be drowned, I admit, or the world would be overrun, but no decent grown-up cat should be done to death, unless he sucks eggs."
"You wouldn't have thought Rusty very decent if you'd seen him when he came here," said Stella. "He positively looked like the Old Nick."
"I don't believe Old Nick can be so very ugly," said Aunt Jemisina reflectively. "He wouldn't do so much harm if he was. I always think of him as a rather handsome gentleman."
Chapter 17. A Letter from Davy.
"It's beginning to snow, girls," said Phil, coming in one November evening. "And there are the loveliest little stars and crosses all over the garden walk. I never noticed before what exquisite things snowflakes really are. One has time to notice things like that in the simple life. Bless you all for permitting me to live it. It's really delightful to feel worried because butter has gone up 5 cents a pound.
Has it? Demanded Stella, who kept the household accounts.
It has, and here's your butter. I'm getting quite expert at marketing. It's better fun than flirting, concluded Phil gravely.
Everything is going up scandalously, sighed Stella.
Never mind, thank goodness air and salvation are still free, said Aunt Jemisina.
And so is laughter, added Anne. There's no tax on it yet, and that is well, because you're all going to laugh presently. I'm going to read you Davy's letter. His spelling has improved immensely this past year, though he is not strong on apostrophes, and he certainly possesses the gift of writing an interesting letter. Listen and laugh before we settle down to the evening study grind.
Dear Anne, ran Davy's letter, I take my pen to tell you that we are all pretty well and hope this will find you the same. It's snowing some today, and Marilla says the old woman in the sky is shaking her feather beds. Is the old woman in the sky God's wife, Anne? I want to know. Mrs. Lynde has been real sick, but she's better now. She fell down the cellar stairs last week. When she fell, she grabbed hold of the shelf with all the milk pails and stew pans on it, and it gave way and went down with her and made a splendid crash. Marilla thought it was an earthquake at first. One of the stew pans was all dinged up, and Mrs. Lynde strained her ribs. The doctor come and give her medicine to rub on her ribs, but she didn't understand him and took it all inside instead. The doctor said it was a wonder it didn't kill her, but it didn't, and it cured her ribs, and Mrs. Lynde says doctors don't know much anyhow. But we couldn't fix up the stew pan. Marilla had to throw it out. Thanksgiving was last week. There was no school, and we had a great dinner. I ate mince pie and roast turkey and fruit cake and donuts and cheese and jam and chocolate cake. Marilla said I'd die, but I didn't. Dora had earache after it, only it wasn't in her ears, it was in her stomach. I didn't have earache anywhere. Our new teacher is a man. He does things for jokes. Last week he made all of us third-class boys write a composition on what kind of a wife we'd like to have, and the girls what kind of a husband. He laughed fit to kill when he read them. This was mine. I thought you'd like to see it. The kind of a wife I'd like to have. She must have good manners and get my meals on time and do what I tell her and always be very polite to me. She must be 15 years old. She must be good to the poor and keep her house tidy and be good-tempered and go to church regularly. She must be very handsome and have curly hair. If I get a wife that is just what I like, I'll be an awful good husband to her. I think a woman ought to be awful good to her husband. Some poor women haven't any husbands. The end. I was at Mrs. Isaac Wright's funeral at White Sands last week. The husband of the corpse felt real sorry. Mrs. Lynde says Mrs. Wright's grandfather stole a sheep, but Marilla says we mustn't speak ill of the dead. Why mustn't we, Anne? I want to know. It's pretty safe, ain't it? Mrs. Lynde was awful mad the other day because I asked her if she was alive in Noah's time. I didn't mean to hurt her feelings. I just wanted to know. Was she, Anne? Mr. Harrison wanted to get rid of his dog. So we hunged him once, but he come to life and scooted for the barn while Mr. Harrison was digging the grave. So we hunged him again, and he stayed dead that time. Mr. Harrison has a new man working for him. He's awful awkward. Mr. Harrison says he is left-handed in both his feet. Mr. Barry's hired man is lazy. Mrs. Barry says that, but Mr. Barry says he ain't lazy exactly, only he thinks it easier to pray for things than to work for them. Mrs. Harmon Andrews' prize pig that she talked so much of died in a fit. Mrs. Lynde says it was a judgment on her for pride. But I think it was hard on the pig. Milty Bolter has been sick. The doctor gave him medicine, and it tasted horrid. I offered to take it for him for a quarter, but the Bolters are so mean. Milty says he'd rather take it himself and save his money. I asked Mrs. Bolter how a person would go about catching a man, and she got awful mad and said she didn't know. She'd never chased men. The AVIS is gonna paint the hall again. They tired of having it blue. The new minister was here to tea last night. He took 3 pieces of pie. If I did that, Mrs. Lynde would call me piggy. And he ate fast and took big bites, and Marilla is always telling me not to do that. Why can ministers do what boys can't, I want to know. I haven't any more news. Here are 6 kisses. XXXXXX. Dora sends 1. Here is hers. X. Your loving friend, David Keith. P.S. Anne, who was the devil's father, I want to know.